Okay. This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Dr. William Meffert. Today is April 29th, 2011, and we are in Herndon, Virginia. All right, why don't we begin, sir, if we could, if you could tell me a little bit of biographical information about yourself. First of all, when and where were you born?
I was born in 1936 in Iowa City, Iowa.
All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
Well, my father, his name was Clyde. He was a doctor in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, a surgeon, and served in World War II with Patton's Army, and participated in Bastogne and the Battle of the Bulge, that sort of thing. And my mother, my mother's first name was Elsie, and she left Iowa to get her master's degree at Columbia University, and they both met earlier in college, and they decided to live their life in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and that's where I grew up.
Okay, yes, sir. All right. Where did you go to high school there?
To Franklin High School in Cedar Rapids.
Okay, all right. Let's see, what year did you graduate?
1954.
Okay, all right. And was it directly off to college at that point?
Or? Yes, that next fall.
Okay, all right. Where did you go to college?
Duke University.
Okay, yes, sir. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your experience at Duke, what that was like for you?
Well, I was pre-med, and so I was taking quite a heavy load of science, including zoology and biochemistry and analytical chemistry eventually, and qualitative and quantitative chemistry, and been involved about five labs a week, which made for a fairly heavy load, 18 hours plus five labs. And I wrestled a lot in high school, and I wrestled a lot for Duke too. I was on their team, and we traveled a lot up and down the East Coast, and I guess that's what kept me sane with all the studying, because I probably wouldn't have enjoyed it as much if I hadn't done that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we had good times.
All right. Well, did you know all along that you wanted to go to med school and to become a doctor?
I think I probably wasn't too realistic, because it's the only thing I ever considered. And it was very competitive at Duke. Pre-medical courses that were heavily booked and crowded, and I think they really didn't want everyone to be pre-med who was. And so there was a lot of competition.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't always pleasant because of that.
Yes, sir.
And I should have probably had some alternatives, but I just never did.
Mm. Right. All right. And what about the med school itself? Where did you go there?
Well, I went to Yale, and I really had a great time at Yale. It was one of the few times I was treated like an adult that had a responsibility of their own for learning and didn't have to be tested every single step. And we had two main examinations in 4 years. But other than that, the examinations were voluntary. And I so appreciated being treated like an adult that I found it quite a pleasant experience. I mean, you didn't have time to do a lot of the things that you might have enjoyed, like traveling or taking time off for various things that you might have enjoyed. We studied, you know, every night and every weekend. And but they trusted us to learn, and we had oral examinations perhaps every week. By there'd be four or five of us in a professor's office, and must have spent a lot of time with those students, because they'd test you in a congenial way, you know, talk with you like we're talking, sort of, and they had a pretty good idea of what you knew and what you didn't know, and what your concerns were, and I just really liked the atmosphere there a lot. So.
All right. Yes, sir. Okay. Well, what about after that? Was it on to a residency at that point?
We had 6 years of residency. I stayed at Yale for that.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Yeah. I had general surgery first, and then thoracic and vascular, and then a chief residency in cardiac surgery.
Okay. So. Yes, sir. All right. Well, how did you get involved with the Army? How did all of that come about?
Well, it was a competitive system again when you were a resident. We started out with 18 interns. They call them first-year residents now. And we ended up with two chief residents at the end of 6 years, or at the end of 4 years before you were appointed for the final two. And so every year, several people got dropped out of the program. And if you couldn't guarantee you wouldn't be drafted into the Army, they probably wouldn't keep you because they hated to invest that time in your training and then have you suddenly leave the program. So it wasn't a patriotic thing. We all just volunteered out of the because of the competition.
Mm-hmm.
We all volunteered for the Berry Plan.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Could you, for possible future listeners that don't know exactly what the Berry Plan is, could you tell me a little bit about what the Berry Plan was?
The Berry Plan was set up to allow people who were specializing in their training, such as surgery or the subspecialties of surgery, to finish their training before they were taken into the Army. And you volunteered to go in the Army if they'd let you finish your training, rather than take you out in the middle of your training, which was quite disruptive. And not only personally, but to be drafted out of a competitive program when you're in pretty heavy competition, it would be hard to get back in the program again.
Mm-hmm.
So we all volunteered for that reason, not particularly out of patriotism, although back then I guess I believe that we had a place in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, timeline-wise, as far as this is concerned, when you were going through residency, when would this have been?
Well, I finished up in 1968, late 68.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I know you mentioned at the time feeling that America belonged, if you know. Had you paid close attention to what was going on, though? Did you follow it through the media?
No, I really never watched television, and I might read a newspaper now and then. I knew we were getting more involved right along. And it seemed like, from what I'd read, that it was probably a good thing to do to prevent the domino effect, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have time or the inclination to really study the different reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Was there? Did you see much of the war protests on the campus there?
No, I spent my life in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And anybody who was protesting would be downtown somewhere, and I never went there.
Mm-hmm.
I just lived the life of a medical monk, more or less.
Sure. So. Okay. All right. Well, since you had volunteered and once you were finished with the residency, was it on to the Army at that point, and was it?
I had orders when I graduated, just before I finished residency. I got orders for Camp Zama in Japan.
Okay.
And so we sold our car. We sent all of our household belongings, all of our winter clothing, all my medical books to study for boards to Japan. And then my wife stayed and waited, expecting to go to Japan. She stayed with my family in Iowa while I went down to Fort Sam Houston for training.
Okay. All right. And could you tell me a little bit about what the training was like? Was
Well, we learned what a high-velocity gunshot would do, one that was a bullet that was traveling 2,500 feet a second as opposed to a 45, for example, an M16 or an AK compared with a 45. That was quite dramatic. And we operated on sheep that had been shot there, and we looked at what the bullet did when it went through gelatin and hit a glass rod at a distance. The shock wave would break the glass rod, which happened in Vietnam. A lot of bone would break that wasn't actually struck by the bullet. Because of the shock wave, the bullet would be a quarter of an inch in diameter, perhaps, plus or minus. But the shock wave would be a foot in diameter that went through a person's leg, for example. And it wasn't unusual to have a little entrance wound like you saw tonight and a big exit wound. But the main thing was not the destruction that the bullet did particularly, but the shock wave. It would just rip things apart. And many times damage things that were quite some distance away. You had to be very careful and take out all the dead tissue that the shockwave caused, as well as the bullet, which sometimes would break up and cause multiple shockwaves in the tissues of the body. So I learned that down there. The rest of it was not. I mean, we played toy soldier with the compass at night, people trying to find us, and we crawled under gunfire and this sort of thing, but it was sort of taken as a joke by us, because although I did see the need to get in really good shape, and it was back then I think I first started to jog seriously and take my conditioning seriously, because I figured it just might be really smart before you went to a war zone to be in fairly decent shape. So that started then too.
All right. any particularly memorable moments or funny moments, anything like that from that training that sticks out in your mind?
Well, one of the things I'll always remember is going through a line to have the people that worked in the office examine your orders.
Are you guys, hold on, stop. Are you guys in the middle of something kind of major?
Yeah.
I'll find somewhere else.
They looked at my orders and they said, Camp Zombie, 3-year commitment. And I said, well, my orders only say 2 years. And I have other commitments after 2 years. They said, well, Captain, if you don't sign up for the 3rd year, we'll change your orders. And I had already, you know, they already had me ship, sell the car, send our clothing, all the books, all of our household things, my wife's sewing machine, all this, over to Camp Zomba, where I had orders. And to me, it seemed like blackmail.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget that. And that was the first time I really began to dislike the Army and to distrust some of the people in the Army. I thought it was really a very poor thing to do. I called my wife. They did change my orders, actually. After we'd been in training there for a couple of weeks, I got orders for Vietnam. I told my wife. She came down to San Antonio to be with me, left the two kids in Iowa, and we faced it. I didn't think that signing up for a 3rd year was a wise thing to do, particularly since it had been handled that way, because I thought if they're going to do that, they'll send you to Vietnam anyway after 2 years. So I just didn't do that, and sure enough, the orders got changed. Well, she was pretty upset, and I had planned to probably go into academic medicine. But she got to know Iowa, where we grew up, and over that year, and it really changed the rest of our lives. I ended up practicing in Iowa. And it might have been traced back to the change of orders. It seems rather strange. But anyway, so I had a pretty unfavorable impression of that in the first introduction to the Army.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, this is getting a little a little loud over here. I'm not sure what's going on, but so once the orders were changed, I'm not sure this is gonna work. Let me pause this for a minute.
Is there a place in here?
Okay. So once the orders were changed, were you then at that point sent to Vietnam pretty soon afterwards, or
within about 3 weeks?
Oh wow, wow! So not much time to prepare then.
Well, we went through a basic training, such as it was.
Right. Okay. So that was before the basic then. Okay.
Well, we got down to Fort Sam, and it was in the first week that they reviewed all of our orders. And so then we had, as I recall, it must have been 3 or 4 weeks of basic training. And that was the first week, and we had 3 more after that. Mm-hmm. I think that was right.
Okay. All right. Well, tell me, I guess, a little bit about the trip over to Vietnam and what that was like for you.
Well, I'll never forget that either. I waited in Oakland at the naval terminal for several days for a plane, and I was rooming with two Vietnam veterans that had come back. They went out every night and partied all night and drank, you know, and so forth. And I, of course, I was just entering, and they were just leaving, and their attitude was almost psychotic, exuberant, and I was scared out of my mind. Mm-hmm. And so I was it was the first time I really didn't have anything to do. I mean, I've been going through this rigid training thing for 12 years after college, and I stood there and watched a football game. Everybody was drinking beer, and I couldn't quite believe the life and the exuberance of these people. And I was actually glad to leave. But we left at midnight, took a bus out to it's an air base out there near Sacramento. I can't remember. Anyway, they bussed us out, everyone very quiet, and several buses. And we loaded on a 707 Flying Tiger Airlines. And I think they had their full gear on at that time. Mm. And everybody very quiet and with their uniform. I think they had their guns, as I recall, and upright seats, no, very hard to sit. The plane was really loaded. And we took off, and Travis is the name of that airbase.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew over San Francisco, and I remember looking down at those lights and seeing them disappear underneath the right wing. And I thought, my God, I may never see those again. Mm. That was a pretty tough feeling. Then we landed in the middle of the night in Honolulu, and we met a group of soldiers coming back from Vietnam, and they were hollering and shouting and drinking beer, and they'd see you and knew you were going over by your clean fatigues and probably by the look on your face. They say, "Oh, you fucking new guys, you watch out, you're gonna get your asses shot off," you know, all this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you'd go in the John, you'd run into a bunch of these mm-hmm. people. So then we got back on the airplane and we flew to Guam. And we landed in Guam, which is up on a high cliff. It's a pretty dramatic entrance. And we went to the John, the same thing happened again. We ran into more planes coming back.
Right.
They said, "Fucking new guys."
Yeah.
You know, you right. won't be thinking this much. You won't be thinking this is a picnic. You know, watch out, keep your head down, all this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we landed at Tan Son Nhut, and the doors opened, and there was this humid, hot air, this heavy air that smelled like diesel fuel and charcoal and rotten fish, and these people running around, the Vietnamese with their hats, and you realize, my God, this isn't National Geographic, this is real. And you heard the Phantom jets taking off, this huge noise right beside where we were parked. And we all got herded over and sat down in chairs, and somebody told us what we had to do the rest of the day, you know, check our money in, get a haircut, be sure to not to try to sleep in if there's any noise, run for the rocket shelter and this sort of thing, because people were killed there last week and we did not. And that all happened in one day, you know, basically. So that's kind of my memory of going over there. It was pretty rough. Mm-hmm. You thought, I'll probably never make it out of here. You sort of thought of your wife, your family, your parents. And at that point, you still sort of believe that you had America had a good cause. I did at that point.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, did you already know at that point that you were going to the 95th evac, or?
No, we got that, I think the next day, we got our assignments. They took us over to the headquarters. I'm not sure whether it may have been the headquarters of all the different corps, first, second, third, and fourth corps.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got my assignment then. And then I think later that day we flew up in a C-130 and landed at Da Nang.
Okay.
And I was met there by an ambulance and drove. I got into the 95th just after they had moved into their new quarters.
Okay. All right. Well, could you tell me a little bit about your first impressions of the 95th, of the hospital itself, some of the staff, that type of thing?
Well, it was very clean. I thought it was well staffed. I met a surgeon the next morning, introduced myself, and he said, "Well, why don't you?" He said, "I've got 2 weeks left. Why don't you follow me along and see what we're up against and see how we deal with different things?" And I thought that was quite helpful. I operated with him and talked with him about cases, and I don't remember his name. I didn't particularly have much to do with the administration at the hospital at that time, because we sort of melded into the surgical personnel and just started working. And I met them as time went on. But I was impressed with the facility. You know, it was just new, of course. They had a pretty good laboratory. They could run arterial blood gases and chemistries. They had respirators in the ICU. We had plenty of blood. We only ran out about 2 days in the whole year I was there. I thought the people in the A&D room or the emergency room were well trained, mainly by experience, and very helpful. The nurses knew what to do, and I was quite impressed right after training to go there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I was inexperienced, of course.
Right, sure, all right. Now, as you began to settle into your work and the job, I guess could you talk a little bit about what your daily schedule, what your routine or your daily schedule would have been like?
At the hospital?
Yes, sir.
Well, I would get up in the morning, probably 6 or so, as I usually have time, make rounds, check on the patients we'd operated on the day before, set up the operating schedule for closing the wounds that we had left open for a few days, check on especially the really ill people in the intensive care unit. I'd usually see them first before anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go to surgery and close the wounds up, and this would be assuming it was a quiet day. A lot of the fighting was at night, so a lot of times you got called to A&D at night and you didn't get up in the morning because you're already up, and one day blurred into the next, and you slept when you could. You slept on the floor or on a gurney somewhere when it was really busy, and you just made it up as you went along. You kept track of the sick patients you'd operate on, got them ready as soon as you could for evacuation. You took care of the acutely ill, and tried to close up the older wounds when you had time between the major cases. And it was a very fast learning curve. You learned that the training that you had of being very meticulous just didn't work until you got control of the blood loss. Mm-hmm. And if you try to be meticulous at the beginning, you lose the patient. Mm-hmm. So you had to be what people in academic medicine might think would be a very rough surgeon, a very gross surgeon. I mean, sometimes scooping the blood out of the abdomen with your hands, big blood clots, running blood clots. They'd still, the nurse would try to catch what she could with the basin and sucker, but most of it would roll right over the side onto the floor, and you could feel the clots between your toes. We were in shorts with sandals because it was so hot. Sweat was running off your glasses into the wound. And you had to get the blood out of the abdomen, assuming we're talking about intra-abdominal injuries, had to get the blood out of the abdomen so you could see where the bright blood was coming from, and you had to jam a sponge in there as quickly as you could. Maybe you had a minute or 30 seconds, so your opening would be very fast. Sometimes, and I'm talking about critically ill patients, the patient might not even be quite asleep, but unconscious because of the severity of the wound. And they would never remember anything. I talked to lots of them. But you had to get in there fast and stop the blood loss. Then, kept your hand over where the bright red blood was coming from. You transfused the patient. You got things under control, got some more help, got some blood hung up, three or four units brought in and ready, one or two running, and then you went after the injury. That's the way you save those soldiers. And then once you got control of the bleeding, you could be meticulous like you were trained, but you couldn't be. You had to learn not to be meticulous at first, and that was hard for freshly trained surgeons, you know. But yes, very critical.
Right.
Very critical.
Yes, sir.
So.
All right. Could you talk, I guess, a little bit about, I'm not sure what role you would play in this, but as far as the triage system is determining who would be operated on, how did that work?
We always had one or two emergency room doctors, A and D doctors. They got quite good at triaging, and we very rarely had what they call nowadays is an expectant category, where you thought somebody was going to die, and so you put them over in a corner somewhere and let them die. That happened in World War II and in Korea, I guess, but I don't remember that happening in our hospital. Very rarely. I mean, somebody with a terrible head injury and brain sort of running out, or other severe multiple wounds, maybe, but that was rare. Usually we took the worst wounded patient right to surgery and tried our best to save their life. We lost some in surgery that way, but a lot of times we saved them, especially if you were quick with the blood loss, stopping that.
All right. I guess I know it would depend on the day, but if you could estimate, about how many surgeries would you be doing per day?
Well, when it was quiet, I went to the Arvin Hospital, the Army Hospital, Vietnamese Army Hospital, and to the civilian hospital across town. And I worked with a Dr. Phuc there, Phouc, who happens to be in Houston.
Oh, okay.
He came over for a training session with the American College of Surgeons, and while he was gone, I think Saigon fell. And I've never spoken with him about the details, so I don't know what happened. But anyway, he's in Houston. And we worked a lot together. And Dr. Polite, who you may have, well, you didn't meet him, he gave us his dictation last night, but Dr. Polite is a cardiologist. And we would work, we'd make rounds over at the Vietnamese Civilian Hospital together quite often, and we had a particular interest in rheumatic fever, and he could, by listening, he was a very skilled diagnostic.
This is Jay.
Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with Dr. Bill Meffert. Today is May 26, 2011. I'm in Lubbock, Texas in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Dr. Meffert is joining me by phone from California. And this is interview session number two. Okay, I wanted to begin, if we could. First of all, I know last time you were talking about, you mentioned that your father was with Patton's Army in World War II and had participated in the Battle of the Bulge. Did he ever talk with you much about those experiences?
A little bit. He sort of had to be prodded a little bit. He didn't voluntarily come up in our conversation, but I know that at one point they lost their hospital. They got the patients out and all the personnel got out, but they lost their physical hospital during the Battle of the Bulge. And then I think after that they turned north. Patton's Army turned north and managed to break through the German lines to get to Bastogne.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And the weather cleared. That helped a great deal.
Right. All right. I just remembered that you had mentioned that last time. I just wanted to ask you, had he mentioned it? But did his experiences, I guess, have any impact, and his career as a doctor, have any impact on your decision to become a doctor as well?
Well, it's really it was really about the only thing I wanted to be after about eight or so. I used to go around with them all the time to the hospital. And later on in college and medical school, I'd spend free time with them too, going into the operating rooms, at least as an observer, and meeting patients with him and talking about things. I've been interested in medicine since way before college.
Jumping now back to about where we left off the last time that we did an interview session, I want to ask you a little bit about the operating room and the staff there where you guys would perform the surgeries. Could you talk a little bit about the staff, like how large the staff was and what some of the different jobs were there?
As I recall, we had at least six operating rooms.
Okay.
It may have been eight, but I think it was six. It was just opposite the intensive care unit and opposite the blood bank and the lab, so it was quite an efficient setup. We would often run four or five operating rooms at a time, sometimes six, when the casualties were very abundant. And we had... didn't have as many anesthesiologists as we needed, but the people that the techs were very good at giving the anesthetic and intubating these critically ill patients, and I thought they did an excellent job. The nurses also were very competent. You tended to work with certain ones because of the specialty. I mean, I was in general doing general surgery, but also chest and vascular, and so I tended to work with just a few nurses rather than everyone.
Okay.
And they were very good. I was very impressed with them.
Sir. All right. What would, I guess, some of the other specialties be besides chest and vascular?
We had orthopedic surgeons, several of the orthopedic surgeons. We had ENT surgeons, neurosurgeons, urologic surgeons, and we had dentists. One or two dentists were there.
Okay.
I may be leaving one or two out, but we pretty much shared the patient load, and oftentimes if if a patient were severely injured, more than one system would be involved. So you might find yourself operating on a patient who had an abdominal or chest problem, and someone else would be operating on the same patient with taking care of a head injury or fixing a shattered leg. So we have multiple teams on lots of patients.
Well, I know that I asked you this question last time, but this is one of the parts of the audio that was a bit distorted. Could you talk a little bit about, I guess some memorable patients that stick out in your mind that you operated on?
Well, I guess the most memorable one was the last one. A patient, a thin soldier, thin boy, who lived in Iowa, I found out afterwards, not far from where I grew up. And he was brought in shock and had an entry point of shrapnel, I think, or perhaps it was a bullet, in the upper abdomen, and his blood pressure was about 60 over 40, something like that. And we took him to surgery, had a lot of blood in the abdomen, and the spleen was shattered. There were holes in the stomach and small bowel, and we were able to take the spleen out fairly rapidly. It was bleeding, and we closed the openings in the rest of the injury, closed the bowel openings, and noticed when we were sort of halfway through the surgery that there was a small opening in the diaphragm, and when the anesthesiologist would inflate the lung, a small bit of blood would come through that hole into the abdominal cavity from the chest cavity. And so I opened that. I opened the diaphragm, and I could see that there was a hole in the sac around the heart and around the pericardium. So we opened the sac, the pericardium, and there was a wound of the left ventricle, and every time the heart beat, blood would shoot out of this hole. And of course, we just had this small incision in the abdomen, in the upper abdomen, a midline vertical incision, but he was thin enough that we could fix that hole in the heart through the abdomen. And so he ended up with a repair of his left ventricle, repair of the diaphragm, the spleen removed, multiple perforations of the stomach and small bowel through a little short incision. That was sort of typical of the unusual situations you found yourself in, where the usual approach would have been to split the sternum if you knew he had a cardiac wound and get a more direct approach. But many of these soldiers were thin enough, and we had room enough to do some unusual things through unorthodox incisions, and we did that fairly often, actually.
Okay. Any other memorable patients as well that you could mention?
Well, I suppose the most troubling cases were the ones that had multiple injuries, such as a head injury and leg amputations, loss of vision, all in the same patient. And you sort of wondered if you were really doing them a service to save their life, really. I mean, what kind of a life would they have? But we couldn't help but cross your mind, but we didn't make that decision for them. I mean, we did the best to save all their lives. And it's troubled me at the time and subsequently what kind of a life they would have. And I'm sure it hasn't been the most pleasant in many cases, although probably better than you might think in others. But there's a kind of a moral question that came up again and again of exactly what we were doing there. And I'd say maybe even more so in the Vietnamese, where the same thing happened, but they would have less support after they recovered.
Well, once a wounded soldier had been operated on by you all, what would happen at that point to them?
Depended on the injury.
Okay.
Usually the orthopedic cases were sent out fairly rapidly to Japan or Okinawa or even back to the States in a few days. If we could only complete part of the operation, we would keep the patient around until they recovered enough to go back and finish the operation, finish the repair. And by that I would mean a severely injured abdominal, a patient with a severely injured abdomen would have the intestine closed, and the damaged part, the worst damaged part, removed. But perhaps there would be a lot of bleeding from the liver. And in that case, after the patient's temperature was going down to levels at which the blood clotting would be insufficient, we sometimes would put a pack in the liver wound and take the patient to the intensive care unit, and then go back the next day or the day after that to take the pack out of the liver and remove any tissue that wasn't alive or stop any bleeding that was still occurring.
All right. Would you ever hear of the fate of soldiers that you had operated on and been sent on, say, to another hospital or back to the States? Would you ever hear about what happened to them?
You know, I never did. That was one thing that I really missed, too, because I would have really liked to have the follow-up. And I guess you could always get a follow-up on patients in general simply by going to the VA hospital. We have a big VA hospital here in Palo Alto, but it wouldn't be your patients. And I just haven't done that. Maybe I'm just reluctant to, but I'm curious, but I haven't ever followed through. And nobody's actually presented my particular cases to me. I'm aware of the general results from surgery in Vietnam and the comparison of surgery there with World War II and then subsequent wars such as Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, in the 95th operating room, and when you would work there, I know you talked the last time about also volunteering at some of the Vietnamese hospitals, but when you were working in the 95th, did you guys only treat Americans, or would casualties from other countries come in as well?
We treated everybody who came in, lots of civilians, quite a few Vietnamese Army personnel who were wounded, and a fair number of Viet Cong. Mm-hmm. And we never really neglected anybody. They were, as far as I was concerned, they were treated the same. So I think that treatment was almost equal. There were two nights that I recall out of the whole year that we ran out of blood for transfusing. And in that case, we just operated on the Americans till we got more blood. But that was the only time that we ever really showed any difference in the treatment.
Okay. Yes,
a severely wounded Vietnamese who might die was taken before a lot of Americans who were pretty stable.
Okay.
Taken to surgery.
Right. talking. You mentioned operating on the Viet Cong soldiers. Was there any sort of special rules or procedures for working on them regarding safety and that type of thing?
I really personally was not aware of any difference.
Okay.
Usually when they're severely wounded, they're just, everybody's the same, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The war's essentially over, and everyone has this human need, and it wasn't very often that we had any incident related to what side they were on, and I don't think that we had any special guarding or anything like that, but maybe that did happen occasionally. I know that the Vietnamese Army Hospital had a separate area where the prisoners were behind bars.
Okay.
And I'm not sure whether they operate on the Viet Cong or not. I think they must have, though, but we did occasionally.
All right. Did you ever detect any sort of resentment towards you guys working on them, say, regarding other patients, American soldiers that, you know, that were in the hospital, that type of thing? Did you ever see anything like that?
No, I never did.
Okay.
Never did see that.
All right. You mentioned a moment ago about the couple of nights of running out of blood. Outside of that, was the hospital well equipped, and did you guys always have the equipment and the supplies and things that you needed?
Well, I think we did. I mean, we had all the supplies you could reasonably expect in a war zone.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the lab did an excellent job with blood tests. The intensive care unit had respirators that were good for the time. They're outmoded now, of course. The blood bank was very aggressive in providing blood rapidly, usually just type specific if the need were immediate. We saw a fair number of rashes from the blood not being cross-matched really carefully in that situation, but that was not a big thing compared with loss of life if you had waited for the very careful match. There were some things. I mean, they didn't have a heart and lung machine, and we could have used it to operate on Vietnamese civilians with more severe heart problems than just the mitral stenosis that we worked on. But I don't think you can expect that in a war zone. We certainly didn't.
Sir. Where would the blood come from? Was it donated from soldiers, or where would the blood come from?
You know, I'm not really sure of that, Jason. I think the Red Cross collected it, but maybe the Army did too. I never really looked into that. We had an ample supply.
All right. I know last time you also talked about on your off day, sometimes you would go to the Vietnamese hospitals. Could you talk, I guess, a little bit more about those experiences? Was this something you decided to do on your own? Was it a volunteer thing, or was this encouraged, or how did that work?
It was encouraged, but you didn't have to do it. I happened to meet some Vietnamese doctors that I thought that I respected and that were hardworking and pleasant to spend time with. And so one of them was a Dr. Fuch. I guess I told you he's in Houston, at least the last time I knew. But he would come over to the 95th once or twice a week, and we'd make some rounds and talk about things. And then at least once or twice a week, I'd go over there if things were quiet. If it were if you were on third call and it was pretty quiet, usually we could go spend the day at either the Vietnamese Army or the civilian hospital. Mm-hmm. And he and I would operate together over there. Their conditions were quite primitive. They lacked lots of things that we took for granted, such as chest tubes that you use fairly frequently in a combat situation to drain blood out of the chest. And we had a special plastic receptacle that we could apply suction to and so forth. And they just used Coke bottles filled halfway up with water and had the tube drain into that. And the nurses didn't provide any particular care for the patient. It was linen changes and the washing of the patient, and the meals were all supplied by the family's relatives.
Okay.
And there was an intense overcrowding. There were I think 800 patients and 400 beds at the civilian hospital, as I recall.
Wow. How about with the Vietnamese, with the military hospitals, was there much difference in the facilities and I guess the equipment and things that they had there between when comparing the military and civilian hospitals?
The military and the civilian hospitals were very similar in their equipment. And there were lots of patients that hadn't been attended to in the emergency rooms of those hospitals. The number of Vietnamese physicians was inadequate, and it seemed like you could just go by rows and rows of people that had been admitted to the emergency room but not treated yet. And there wasn't much ability to take care of big burns or complex injuries. They just didn't have the personnel or the expertise. So that was upsetting. I thought the Vietnamese doctors tried to do the best they could. They weren't completely trained, lots of them. Dr. Phuc, for example, and several other doctors would come to the evacuation hospital and make rounds and ask a lot of questions, and I think they learned quite a bit from us, and they learned about our equipment too.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, I know the last time that you talked quite a bit about your impressions of Dr. Phuc, and unfortunately that was one of those parts that was a little difficult to hear as well, I believe. Could you talk a little bit more, I guess, about Dr. Phuc and your impressions of him?
Actually, I didn't myself initiate that. He came to the 95th Evacuation Hospital to make rounds with surgeons. He was a partially trained surgeon. I think he'd had a year or two training in France and then some more training in Vietnam. And he was very eager to learn, and he came on his own initiative on his motorbike and just showed up in the emergency room, and either I was there or they called me to come and talk to him, and we made rounds, and he asked me to come and make rounds at the Vietnamese civilian and the Vietnamese Army hospital. He was in the Vietnamese Army. And so we spent time at both the Vietnamese hospitals together and made rounds and talked about the different patients and what could be done and what couldn't be done. And then we agreed to find patients that couldn't be treated very well or couldn't be treated at all with surgical problems that were too complicated for their hospitals, and we sorted through the ones that we thought we could help, and they set up a fairly large tent outside of our hospital, and the patients that needed surgery were transferred there with their families, and they set up sort of their own little community right outside of our hospital. And then Dr. Fuch would come over, and we'd operate on those patients. And sometimes when he wasn't around, we'd operate on them ourselves when it was a fairly slow period. So we took care of quite a few Vietnamese patients with interesting wounds or complex wounds by just transferring them to our hospital and waiting for a time that it was quiet and safe to take care of them. And we gradually got to know each other as well as you can in that situation. He brought his fiancée over one night for me to meet, and she was just a lovely person. And we went out for a few times and had some beers and so forth, and just had a quite a interesting, congenial time together that year.
What was your impression, I guess, if you wouldn't mind, of just of Vietnamese civilians? Just your impression of them.
Well, the people that had a little something material-wise were in much better condition than the people that were living in the country. And Da Nang was not a particularly sophisticated city when we were there. It was more of a rural city, and most of the people, very rarely could they speak English. They didn't have really much in the way of material things. They rode bicycles. A few of the better off people rode motorbikes and a few motorcycles. Pedicabs were used. Lots of them didn't. They wore sandals and very ordinary clothing. I suppose most of our patients were rural and not used to any luxuries. They seemed confused and dazed and of course, they were worried, and they were usually injured, and it was a very awful time for them. But you couldn't help but like them. I mean, they weren't lazy. They weren't antagonistic, and they seemed to trust you and care for what you tried to do for them. I suppose. You know, civilian injuries in a city might have been a little different experience, and didn't have too many that were injured in Da Nang itself, and didn't have any that were injured from Saigon either.
Yes, sir. Did you ever, or were you ever able to, I guess, get away from the hospital and see a little bit of Da Nang? Vietnam outside of the hospital, or was your time completely spent there?
We went down to Saigon to take written board exams.
Yep.
After about 6 months. Saw a little bit of Saigon, but it really wasn't, Da Nang wasn't a place where you wanted to poke around and go in back alleys and that sort of thing. It wasn't particularly safe. I was always a little uneasy about driving a Jeep around. Usually we had someone that drove it for us, but you just felt exposed. And quite a few times we would take an ambulance because it seemed safer. You could close the doors and roll up the windows, and nobody could throw a grenade inside. I guess they could throw it underneath, but it just seemed like you were in a safer situation. And Saigon, we just landed at Tan Sanut, as I remember, and stayed overnight in the main hospital there, the main army hospital, and took the written exam the next morning and then flew back to Da Nang. So I didn't see much of Saigon, just a little bit, walking some of the streets, the main streets, but that seemed quite a bit Well, quite a bit more of a mature metropolis than Da Nang.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. We mentioned the dangers there around Da Nang. Was the hospital ever mortared, or did it ever come under attack while you were there?
We were not intentionally, I don't think, intentionally. We were near a Marine base called Tenshaw, and some of the rockets came right near us that were meant for the Marines, I think. We had one night when we thought we thought the enemy was trying to get through our barbed wire, and some helicopters came over and that sort of thing. We had one of the guards was shot, just a minor injury one night. There wasn't any concentrated attack. We were quite exposed to attacks from the ocean. I mean, that was pretty much unguarded except for several rows of barbed wire and some sentry posts. So we could have been, but I think that the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese sort of looked upon hospitals with some favor because, after all, we took care of a lot of those people, too.
Mm-hmm. Sir.
And maybe that was the reason why they didn't really bother us too much.
Yes, sir. Well, I know we've talked about your time in surgery and also volunteering at the Vietnamese hospitals, but how else would you spend your free time if you had any? What types of things would you do if you had any free time?
Well, I didn't have a whole lot of free time because if we weren't doing much at our hospital, I'd usually go find Dr. Fook and we'd do something over at one of his hospitals. I used to write quite a few letters home, make some tapes for the kids telling stories. There was a little store there where you could buy things like cookies and soft drinks, and we'd do that. We had an officers' club in the evenings you could go to if you wanted to. I didn't hang out too much there. And I read quite a bit getting ready to take surgical boards. I went through major techs and all the subspecialties just to get ready for the board exam. So, I wasn't aware I had a whole lot of time. I mean, I wasn't just sitting around watching the hours go by hoping to get out of there. It went pretty fast, really.
Yes, sir. Did you have an R&R?
Yes. We went to Hawaii. And also, I left the hospital, I think about five times, taking patients to Japan, usually severely wounded patients. And then you'd spend that day and the next day in Japan and then come back to the hospital after that. So that was a little relief. And I suppose it added some safety to have a physician on the plane with some of these badly wounded patients.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, anything else, any other memorable moments or anything else we should cover about your time in country before talking about coming home?
Well, I suppose my attitude changed towards the war. Maybe we've talked about that before, but it's not that I'm anti-authority, but it's caused me to question political and military moves more than I used to. I mean, I used to, being from the Midwest, we're pretty trusting people. To politicians and military personnel, we tend to take them at their word, at least when I was growing up. But then after seeing some of the repeated injuries, taking the same land and giving it up, there was one hill in, near the hospital that was taken and then given back to the enemy three times in 1 year, and at least two dozen soldiers, I think, were killed each time it was taken. And that really changed my attitude. It's one thing to list on a piece of paper 24 soldiers were lost, but it's quite another to see 48 or 50 boots in the emergency room and the dead soldiers there too.
Yes, sir.
And it really made me upset and somewhat angry and distrustful of authority, at least suspicious, and I'm much more apt to investigate what motivates some of the decisions now than I did. So I guess in that respect, it changed my thought process. Another thing that I was a little surprised about is how it's just a sometimes a odd circumstance whether you're not hurt or whether you're hurt badly or killed. It just sort of mattered where you were at a certain time, whether you were in trouble or not in trouble. And that was probably one of the most upsetting things of all, because I think we all, or at least most of us, were reasonably cautious. But sometimes it just didn't make any difference. It's just that you were in the wrong place. And that, I guess at the time it didn't bother me particularly, but when I think back about it, looking at, talking with some of the people that were there and looking at some of the photographs, and you realize that an isolated decision could spell the difference between life and death sometimes.
Yes, sir.
And it's a little shocking.
Yes, sir. Well, did this, evolution or change in your views on the war, this change in your thinking, did it happen early on in your tour, or was it something that happened late in your tour, or do you remember?
Well, I think it was about halfway through. At first, you're really not paying attention to the war. You're trying to learn how to take care of these huge injuries. And a lot of your training, I think I'd mentioned, is to be very meticulous and precise. And there was no emphasis on speed, particularly when you were in training. And I think that's the way it should be. But in a combat situation, unless you can stop the bleeding, you don't have a patient to operate on with your meticulous technique. So you have to do whatever you can to stop the bleeding just as quickly as you can, and if it's a major bleed. And so that was new, and it took a while to learn that. It took a while to relearn anatomy when you were coming at organs from a different approach than usual. It wasn't the usual planned incision lots of times. And it got to be pretty amazing what you could do through unplanned and atypical approaches after a while. We learned all that. And that took a few months, but then after a while you saw some of these repetitive situations. And it really made you wonder. I mean, especially when they would make all these aggressive patrols to retake these hills and interdict the supplies coming down from the north. But then, because there weren't enough army personnel to cover all the country, I mean, there never are enough, then the supply train would start up again. And a lot of the rules for combat were decided in Washington, even down to what type of bullets the planes could use, or bombs. And for instance, I had quite a few pilots that told me that they couldn't bomb trucks that they saw because they were parked in North Vietnamese villages. And they only drove at night, and back then they couldn't see them very well with the whatever gear they had. you know, it just seemed like we were fighting with one arm behind our back, but our casualties were real and awful, and could have been prevented by stopping the inflow of goods by just destroying the North. But then, of course, you realize that China probably would have intervened, and I'm sure that the military commanders were concerned about that. It was frustrating to be in a war that you could see the problems were not, the basic problems were not being controlled. Maybe they just couldn't have been, but in that case, then we shouldn't have been there, I don't think.
Yes, sir. All right. Did you talk about, I guess, your views? Did you and some of the other surgeons ever, sit around and talk about these things?
Oh, all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, we used to talk about them, sometimes at night, usually. I mean, we'd usually be busy, fairly busy during the day, but it was a pretty common topic about the casualties and the repetitive nature of taking the same hill or going on the same patrol all the time instead of being able to stop the infiltration.
Yes, sir. Did most everyone seem to be of the same mindset as you about the war?
I think so. I suppose the RA people, like the CO of the hospital, would not agree, but you know, you wouldn't expect him to, I guess. But we were just civilians there for a year. It seemed pretty obvious to us what was going on.
Yes, sir. Well, I know you talked about the surgery quite a bit different as far as not being meticulous and at first, just having to focus on stopping the blood and just the differences there and dealing with some of those very traumatic type injuries. What type of impact, did that have on your later career as a surgeon? Did it have a positive impact?
Oh, I think so. I got a lot faster in my surgery. My overall times for certain operations declined markedly, and it wasn't that I was hurrying. It was just sort of a tempo you picked up after a while, and I don't think I was passing over the fine points. But in order to be efficient, after lots of cases, I would just think about the case and think about where I could have saved time and not lost any carefulness or any precision, I should say. And that happened in the civilian work afterwards, too. I would think about combining steps or eliminating things that were not helpful and using different instruments that could do the job better, a little different approach. I think the analysis of the cases started in the Army, much more so than in my training. And I was able to streamline the procedures quite a bit.
Was there anything else about Vietnam that we haven't covered yet before coming home?
Well, I don't. There's all kinds of things, but I can't think of anything else that's really major. I mean, I really appreciated the skill of some of the other doctors there. One of them in particular was Lenny Polite's ability to pick out patients with mitral stenosis, just using a stethoscope. I mean, we were all taught to do that, but in our training, of course, we never would operate on anybody just on the basis of listening to them. And over there, we didn't have any more sophisticated diagnostic equipment, except for Lenny's ear. And he could pick out a narrowed mitral valve that wasn't leaking backwards. And we operated on, I don't know, I can't remember, 5 or 6 of those patients during the latter part of the year. And I thought that was pretty amazing that he was so accurate.
Yes, sir. Right. Well, for possible future listeners, including myself, that may not know what mitral stenosis is, would you mind talking a little bit about what that ailment actually is?
With rheumatic fever, sometimes there's inflammation of the valves of the heart, the valves that go between the upper chamber and the lower chambers on each side, the atriums and the ventricles, okay. Left atrium and ventricle and the right atrium and ventricle. And those valves, when they're inflamed, get swollen and they tend to fuse together in their healing and get narrow. And the very flexible, pliable valve tissue gets thickened and curled up. And so sometimes it gets to be very narrow. The valve between the left side of on the left side of the heart, between the upper and lower chambers, should admit 2 fingers of average size, and sometimes the valve would be narrowed to a pencil point or to a size of a pencil, and that would keep blood from going through the heart the way it needed to, and it would back up in the lungs and result in shortness of breath and heart failure. Are you still there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay. And if that couldn't be opened up, then the patient would eventually die from heart failure. And so if you could be sure that just the narrow valve existed, you could open that with your finger through the upper chamber without a heart-lung machine, and that's what we did.
If you could talk a little bit about the end of your tour and coming home. Did you continue surgeries all the way up until your last days there, or was there a cutoff point?
Well, the last patient was the one I told you about, and
right.
I don't think I operated on the last day I was there. It was the next to the last day that I operated on him, and usually at that time, at that stage of the war, people were leaving Vietnam by going down to Cameron Bay.
Okay.
And then they waited there sometimes for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days even to get out. And the CO of the 95th asked me if I wanted to fly out with this patient who had a wound of the heart. And he asked me if I wanted to leave the next day. I was within about 2 days of my full year tour. So I said, sure, that'd be fine. And so that's how I left. I flew out with him and some other patients aboard a C-141, and we flew to Okinawa. Then the next day to San Francisco and Letterman. And I dropped him off with some surgeons at Letterman. Of course, in Vietnam, we didn't have lengthy operative notes. We didn't have any dictation, nobody to type it if we did have dictation. So you might say severely wounded GI, abdominal incision, spleen removed after found to be fractured, multiple perforations sewn up, diaphragm open, heart found to be bleeding from the left ventricle, closed, wounds closed, patient taken to the intensive care unit. That might be the equivalent of a 4 or 5 page operative note in the States.
Right.
And so they looked at that at Letterman, and they looked at this short incision in the abdomen, and it was a little hard, I think, for them to believe that you could do all that through that type of an incision, but it wasn't intentional. It's just that we kept discovering things, and we could see okay, so we didn't lengthen it.
Right, sir.
It was kind of an interesting thing to have them look at.
Once you returned to the States here, were you done with your Army time at this point, or did you still have some more, still have part of your commitment to go?
Well, I had another year.
Okay.
And we spent that at Fort Ord.
Okay.
In Monterey.
Right. And would you still have been operating on Vietnam casualties there at Fort Ord, or were some coming in there?
This was mainly civilian. Well, there were soldiers, but not wounded soldiers. They had other things, other surgical problems that we took care of, hernias, and women had thyroid problems and breast masses, and it was a sort of a typical general surgical practice there.
Mm.
Then I don't think we did too much vascular or chest surgery, as I recall.
Okay. All right. Once you were back in the States, did you follow the war at all through the newspapers or through any type of media after you returned?
Yes. Yeah, I did. Once you were there, you knew it couldn't end well. And I was quite interested in how it wound down and what finally happened. I mean, it wasn't a surprise at all,
mm-hmm.
Because we really weren't conducting the war in a way it could be won.
Yes, sir. Well, what was your reaction to the way the war wound down and the way it ended with the fall of Saigon?
Well, you know, when you see these 18 and 19 and 20 year old kids torn apart or dead, I mean, it affects you in a way that seeing their names on black marble at the memorial doesn't, at least to me. I mean, it's much more real. You saw it with your own two eyes. It's not represented at some memorial, and I just thought it was a huge waste. I guess I started out believing what the politician said about the domino effect and the necessity to stop communism and all that sort of thing. And I suppose they believed it too. But, you know, the consequences of acting on that and fighting to win would have been another huge world war. And I don't know how they thought they could win without doing that. I mean, I just couldn't see of another way that the desired goals could be accomplished other than wiping out North Vietnam and precipitating probably another huge world war.
Right.
The ending wasn't surprising to me. Maybe they knew or thought they knew something that I never did, but it wasn't a surprise to me. It's kind of like fighting in Afghanistan without controlling the inflow of weapons from Iran. I mean, I don't know how you win those situations. I thought they would have, or somebody would have learned that before.
Yes, sir. Well, before wrapping the interview up, would you mind, I guess, talking a little bit about your career after the military, what you did afterwards?
Well, first of all, I got my boards out of the way, my general surgical boards and my thoracic boards. And then I started looking for a job. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be in academic medicine or in private practice, so I looked at quite a few places. I went back to Yale and looked at a job there, and I looked at Cleveland Clinic, and I looked at smaller clinics in the Midwest. I looked at Stanford out here and at the Palo Alto Medical Clinic. But it seemed to me that a lot of these places, it would take a while to get in a position of responsibility such that you could operate on the cases that you wanted to operate on and do the things you wanted to do. And I just decided to set my own system up in the Midwest and set up an open heart program and a big vascular program, and that's what we did. So, I started all alone and hired another chest and cardiac surgeon. We hired a couple more and then a couple more, and we ended up with 13. And
oh, wow.
Now it's up to, now we joined other specialties. We have over 200 people and 200 physicians or surgeons in the, in the group. And it worked. I enjoyed it. It was a tough goal, and but an interesting one, and I thought we were well supported by the community, and I guess I would do it again. There's never just one way to go. I mean, I think academic medicine would have been interesting too, but quite different.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say, anything else we haven't covered before wrapping the interview up?
Well, I've got lots of fragments in my mind of things that happened. I never took notes over there, which I wish I would have, but on the other hand, I think a lot of people that take the notes don't end up using them, and I can remember lots of little bits of things that happened, and I do write some stories about those, as well as I'm trying not to write just on war stories, just war stories, but some things about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I've written a few, I guess. Did you get the one about the red box?
Yes, sir.
I guess I gave you that one, didn't I?
Yes, sir, you did. Yes, sir.
I don't know whether that's you're interested in keeping that for the archives or not. Or
absolutely, yes, sir.
Okay, well, I guess I should sign the same papers when you get around to it.
Right. I will, yes, sir, I'll have our one of our archivists send those out to you.
Okay, I guess that short story to me is just a little bit crude in the language, I guess to say the least, but I was trying to capture what the average soldier thought, you know, and what the average soldier did, so that's the reason it ended up like that. I can write some more stories that maybe aren't quite so shocking. But anyway, I'm thankful for the memories, and I think sometimes you can explain what happened better with fiction than you can with the facts.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
But anyway, that's what I intend to do some more of.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, we'd certainly love to have them whenever you write. So if you wouldn't mind, we would certainly love to have them as part of our collection as well. So.
Well, thank you, Jason. It's very gracious of you. I'm sort of on a kick now of writing civilian stories, so it may take me a while to get back. But I'm sure I sort of forget about it after a while, and in some ways it's not too comfortable calling up the scenes again, but
sure.
But I could certainly do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate that. All the time you spent and
yes, sir.
All the care.
Well, I certainly appreciate you taking the time to do this, to tell your story, and for sending us those stories that you write as well. So we certainly appreciate it. Let me go ahead and bring the interview to a close now, but I'd like to talk to you for a few more minutes if I could.
Sure, Jason, fine.
Okay.